Have you ever felt like you were drowning in information, like trying to understand something new, but there's just this mountain of data and details?
I think most people experience that from time to time.
Yeah.
We live in a world where we're constantly bombarded with information, and the real challenge is figuring out what's actually important and understanding what it all means.
Exactly. And that's what we try to do here on the Deep Dive. We kind of sift through all the dense stuff, like the research papers and the data, to bring you those key insights, those aha moments that give you a clear understanding without getting bogged down in all the little details. And, you know, we really design these deep dives with a specific person in mind. We call them the learner. Someone who wants to understand complex ideas quickly and thoroughly without having to wade through all the complexity.
It's all about cutting through the noise and getting to the heart of the matter.
Right. And today we're going to deep dive into a paper called Classification Functions for Machine Learning and Data Mining by Tsutomu Sasao from Meiji University. This paper is dated April 6, 2025. What's really interesting about this paper is that it offers a very different approach to machine learning compared to the more common methods that we see today.
It's definitely a unique perspective.
So our mission today is to unpack this alternative approach to classification. We want to understand the fundamental principles, see what its strengths are, and explore the kinds of problems it's best suited for. So the paper starts by addressing a very fundamental problem in data science. How do we classify data? You know, think about a basic task like recognizing whether an image shows an airplane or a car.
And right away, the paper points out that neural networks have become the dominant way to handle this type of image recognition and many other classification problems. They're everywhere these days.
Yeah, but as the paper points out, there are some downsides to this widely used neural network approach. You know, it takes a lot of time to train these networks, and they require a lot of computing power, which means they consume a lot of energy. So they're not exactly a lightweight solution.
And that's where Professor Sasao's work comes in. He proposes a very different strategy that moves away from neural networks entirely and instead explores using techniques from logic synthesis and lookup tables.
Logic synthesis and lookup tables. Okay, so
Yeah.
that sounds pretty different. Can you break down the core idea here for us? Like, how do you apply techniques from logic design to the problem of classifying data?
Sure. So the core of the method involves two main ideas. First, reducing the number of variables you need to look at to describe the data. And second, simplifying these things called sum of products expressions. They're also called SOPs.
SOPs, okay.
You can think of an SOP as a way to write a logical rule. It's basically a bunch of AND conditions linked together by OR conditions. And the goal is to make these rules as simple as possible. It's like creating a series of very specific if conditions. And if any one of those if conditions is true, then you get a certain classification.
So if we simplify these logical rules with fewer factors and fewer overall rules, what's the advantage? Why take this approach instead of just using a neural network?
There are some pretty big advantages, especially in certain situations. The paper emphasizes that this method can lead to much faster training times. It can also use much simpler and less expensive hardware, and it can dramatically reduce power consumption. Imagine you have a small battery-powered device, and it needs to make quick decisions about information, but it can't drain its battery. This approach could be a perfect fit for that kind of application.
That makes sense. Simpler hardware and lower power consumption are definitely big pluses, but I remember there being a trade-off mentioned. What's the downside?
Well, the paper is very upfront about the fact that the accuracy you can achieve with this logic synthesis method is generally lower than what you can get with a well-trained neural network.
Hmm.
So it's not about replacing neural networks entirely. It's more about choosing the right tool for the job, recognizing that in some cases, the advantages in speed and efficiency outweigh a potential small decrease in accuracy.
So maybe a bit less accuracy, but huge gains in speed and efficiency. This leads us to the question of where this approach is most useful. The outline mentions something about ultra-high-speed classification.
Exactly. When you absolutely need to make a classification decision extremely quickly, that's when this method really shines. The paper gives some great examples. Think about packet classification in high-speed internet networks. Data packets need to be routed incredibly fast. Then there's network intrusion detection. There, you need to identify and block malicious activity in real time. Another example is detecting exotic particles in high-energy physics experiments. There, they have these massive amounts of data that need to be analyzed and classified super quickly.
Those are all situations where speed is obviously critical. Now, the outline also mentions medical diagnosis as a potential area where this approach could be useful, which I found a little surprising considering how important accuracy is in healthcare.
Right. But the paper argues that this approach can be particularly useful in medical diagnoses when you don't have a huge amount of data to work with. They call it a small training set, and when the data is imbalanced. This means you have many more examples of one condition than another. In those cases, the fact that these logic-based rules are very easy to understand, what we call interpretability, can be a huge advantage for doctors.
Yeah, interpretability is very important, especially in fields like medicine. It's essential to understand why a decision was made, not just what the decision is. Okay, so just to recap, the core idea here is using logic synthesis for classification. This involves simplifying logical rules and reducing the number of factors you have to consider, and that leads to significant gains in speed and efficiency. This sounds like it's especially useful in applications where things need to happen very fast, or when you have limited data or imbalanced data. Now let's dig a little deeper into some of the key concepts that are introduced in the paper. First up, the classification function. What exactly is a classification function?
The paper defines it as a rule that takes your input data and assigns it to a specific category. Think back to our airplane and car example. The classification function would take an image as input, and then it would output a label, either airplane or car. It's a function that is derived from your training data.
And this builds on a more fundamental idea of a two-class function.
Exactly. A two-class function is the basic building block. It's about distinguishing between two options, like yes or no, or in a medical context, disease present or disease absent. Many complex classification problems can be broken down into or built up from these simpler two-class functions.
Got it. Okay, now we touched on SOPs earlier, some of products. Why is simplifying these logical expressions so important in this approach?
Simplifying SOPs is key because it directly translates to a simpler circuit in hardware. This means you need fewer logic gates, and it also generally leads to faster processing times. The paper gives a really clear example. They have two different ways of writing the same logical function. One is written as F1 equals by 1 by 4 or R by 2 and not by 3. The other is F2 equals by 1 by 4 or R by 1 by 2 or R by 2 by 4. So both of these represent the same logical function, but F1 has fewer and terms while F2 uses fewer variables.
That's interesting. So the best way to simplify really depends on what you're trying to optimize, whether it's the number of rules or the number of factors you're considering within each rule.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And to quantify this, the paper introduces something called the PLA measure. This measure is calculated by multiplying the number of variables by the number of product terms in the SOP. Basically, it gives you a way to compare the complexity of different SOP expressions for the same function. In that example I gave, F1 has a PLA measure of 8, while F2 has a PLA measure of 9. So according to the PLA measure, F1 is slightly less complex.
Okay, I think I'm following. Now, the paper also talks about partially defined classification functions. What does that mean?
So in real-world situations, your training data, the examples you use to teach your system, almost never includes every single possible combination of inputs. There are always going to be some gaps, some scenarios that you haven't seen before, and so you don't know for sure what the correct classification would be. These unknown areas are what create a partially defined function. You only have definite classifications for what the paper calls registered vectors, which are the specific data points in your training set where you know the correct category.
So the training data gives us these registered vectors. And for anything that we haven't seen in the training data, the classification function is considered partially defined. Okay, now what about this idea of a support set?
The support set is a pretty crucial concept. It's the smallest possible group of input variables that you still need to look at in order to distinguish between all the different classes in your classification problem. You're basically trying to find the absolute minimum amount of information you need to make an accurate decision. It sounds a lot like feature selection, doesn't it?
It does sound very similar to feature selection in machine learning. And the paper goes on to define when a variable is essential, what makes a variable essential.
So a variable is considered essential if there are two data points in your training set that differ only in that one variable, and those two data points belong to different classes. The paper has an example 3.1.1, that illustrates this nicely. It shows a function where if you change just one specific variable, it can flip the classification from one category to another. So that variable is considered essential because it plays a key role in distinguishing between those two cases.
Okay. And then the paper gets into how you actually go about finding the smallest set of essential variables, or what they call minimizing the number of variables. The outline mentions an exact method for doing this, but it sounds like it could be quite computationally intensive.
Yeah, the exact method tries to find the absolute smallest set of essential variables by looking at the differences between data points of different classes. It's like trying every single combination to find the perfect fit. It can work well, But as the amount of data grows, it can become really computationally expensive. It's really only practical for problems that have a relatively small number of variables, maybe up to around 100 variables or so.
Okay, so for problems with a lot of variables, that exact method might not be feasible. The outline also mentions a heuristic method for minimizing variables. How is that different?
The heuristic method is presented in Chapter 4, and it's designed to be a more practical approach, even though it doesn't necessarily find the absolute best solution. It uses this idea of an impurity measure to iteratively select variables that are best at separating the different classes in your data. The paper has some helpful figures 4.1.1 through 4.1.5, that visually explain this concept. And there's an example, 4.1.1, that shows how to calculate this impurity measure. It's basically a faster, more step-by-step approach that tries to find a good solution, but not necessarily the absolute best solution in a more reasonable amount of time.
Right, a trade-off between finding the perfect solution and finding a good enough solution more quickly. Now, I know the paper also goes into some statistical findings about these classification functions. Were there any interesting insights from that analysis?
Chapter 5 is where they present some really interesting statistical results. One of the key findings is that if you look at functions with 6 input variables and an equal number of what they call positive and negative examples, you find that on average, you only need to consider about 3 of those variables to correctly classify the data. And what's even more interesting is that over 83% of those functions could be accurately represented using only 3 variables out of the original 6.
Wow, that's a pretty significant reduction. So even when you start with what seems like a moderate amount of information, you often only need to look at a small part of it to make accurate classifications. That could have implications for how we think about selecting features in all sorts of machine learning tasks, not just for this logic-based method.
I think so too. And the paper goes on to look at even larger functions with 16, 20, 24, and 28 variables. And they find that once you get to 20 or more variables, most of these functions can be accurately represented with just 8 or 9 variables. It seems like there's often a lot of redundancy in data, and this approach is good at zeroing in on the truly important information.
That's pretty remarkable. So we've talked a lot about the theory behind this approach, but how does it actually perform in practice? The outline mentions that this method was applied to the MNIST dataset, the handwritten character images.
Yeah, MNIST is a really popular dataset for testing machine learning algorithms. It's a collection of images of handwritten digits 0 through 9. Each image is 28 by 28 pixels. The book explains that they first converted the grayscale pixel values into just black and white using a threshold. Once they had the data in this binary format, they could apply these logic synthesis methods to learn rules for classifying the different digits.
And how did this logic-based approach compare to traditional neural networks? Did it sacrifice a lot of accuracy for speed? The outline also mentions something called linear decomposition as a way to simplify things even further. What is that?
So linear decomposition is introduced in Chapter 6. And it's the idea that you can apply mathematical transformations to your input variables before you even start the classification process. It's kind of like engineering new features that might be more informative. And this can help to reduce the number of variables you need to consider.
So it's like taking those initial pieces of information and combining them in a clever way to create a smaller set of more meaningful features.
Exactly. The book gives several examples. One example looks at classifying countries based on their names. And another example looks at classifying Japanese companies based on their telephone numbers. In both cases, applying these linear transformations to the data really helped to reduce the number of variables needed for accurate classification. The paper also presents results from some experiments on some standard benchmark functions, including different resolutions of the MNIST dataset.
And what about the MNIST character recognition task? How did the linear decomposition approach affect that?
The paper has a table 6.4.4, that shows the results of applying linear transformations to the MNIST data. They were able to reduce the number of variables needed to distinguish between pairs of digits. This kind of simplification can lead to much more efficient hardware implementations, which is important for real-world applications.
That's really interesting. So first, transforming the input data and then simplifying the logic. It seems like a powerful combination for handling complex classification problems. Now, this whole approach might seem pretty different from what our listeners are used to in machine learning. So can we talk about how all of these ideas connect back to more familiar concepts in data mining and machine learning?
Yeah, the paper actually does a great job of making those connections in Chapter 7. It even provides a kind of translation table, table 7.1.1, that maps the different terms used in logic design geometry, data mining, and machine learning. For example, what's called a min term in logic design is basically the same as an example in machine learning. And an SOP is similar to a rule set. So the paper really helps to bridge the gap between these different fields.
That table is really helpful. I also noticed that the chapter discusses the important difference between simply memorizing training data and actually learning general patterns.
Right. Memorizing training data just means you're storing the examples you've seen before. But true learning means you can actually make accurate predictions on data you haven't encountered before. That's what we call generalization, and it's really the key to creating intelligent systems. The paper also emphasizes the importance of explainable or interpretable machine learning, especially in fields like medicine, where trust and transparency are really important.
Yeah, if we can understand the logic behind a decision, it's much easier to trust that decision, right?
Exactly. And simple logical rules, like the ones derived from SOPs, can make the decision-making process much more transparent. This is actually in line with the idea of Occam's razor. The simplest explanation is often the best one. And the variable reduction techniques we were talking about earlier are also closely related to feature selection and traditional machine learning.
So there are a lot of connections between these ideas. Now, I'm curious how this SOP-based method actually stacks up against other more common classification algorithms that our listeners might be familiar with. The outline mentions a comparison with decision tree classifiers.
Yes, in section 7.2, they compare this approach to C4.5, which is a very popular decision tree algorithm. The key difference is that the SOP method tries to find the smallest possible set of rules that perfectly classify the training data. C4.5, on the other hand, focuses on building decision trees that generalize well to new data, even if it means making a few errors on the training set. So, slightly different goals.
And does the paper also talk about how you actually measure the performance of these different classifiers and the challenges of dealing with imbalanced data sets?
Yes. Section 7.3 goes into those details. They talk about common metrics like accuracy, precision, and recall. They also discuss the Matthews correlation coefficient, which is especially useful when working with imbalanced datasets. Then they present some experimental results on various real-world datasets from the UCI Machine Learning Repository, comparing the SOP-based approach with other algorithms like J48, which is a Java implementation of C4.5, and JRIP, another rule-based algorithm.
Interesting. And how did the SOP-based method perform?
The results were pretty good. For some datasets, like the breast cancer and the mushroom datasets, the SOP method achieves high accuracy, and importantly, it generated much simpler and more understandable rules than the other algorithms. There's one example with the mushroom dataset where the SOP method found a solution using only 5 rules and just 3 variables, which was better than a previously known solution that used 5 rules but needed 8 variables. That's pretty impressive.
That's amazing. Same performance, but with much simpler model. What about performance on the imbalanced datasets like hepatitis and thoracic?
In section 8.5, the book shows that the SOP classifier did well in those datasets too. Sometimes it even outperformed J48 and JRIP, especially when you look at this metric called MCC, which, as we said, is a more reliable way to measure performance when dealing with imbalanced datasets.
So the SOP method isn't just theoretically interesting. It actually works well in practice, especially when you need a model that's simple, easy to understand, and able to handle imbalanced data. Now, the outline also mentions a connection between generalization ability, how well a model performs on new data, and SOP minimization. How does simplifying those logical rules actually help with generalization?
That's a really interesting connection that the book explores in Chapter 9. The idea is that by finding the simplest possible SOP representation for your classification task, you're essentially making the most general assumptions about your data, which should help your model perform better on new, unseen examples. It's like you're finding the most concise and logical explanation for the patterns in your data.
Like Occam's razor again, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the book actually provides examples like the Achilles heel function. They also did some experiments where they showed that SOP minimization could successfully reconstruct the original function, even when given only a limited amount of input data.
So it seems like this logic-based approach has a lot of potential, not only for its speed and efficiency, but also for its ability to generalize to new data. Now, the book also talks about handling continuous variables, which are very common in real-world data sets. How do you apply a logic-based method when your data isn't naturally discrete or categorical?
That's a great question. And the paper addresses it head-on in Chapter 10. They present a method for converting continuous variables into discrete categories. So, for example, if you have a blood test result that's a continuous value, you could divide that range of values into different categories.
So you're basically creating bins or categories from those continuous measurements, and then you can apply all the SOP-based classification techniques we've been talking about.
That's right. And the paper shows how they applied this approach to several data sets with continuous variables, things like alcohol consumption, dermatology diagnoses, and the classic iris flower data set. They were able to generate really simple and interpretable rules for classifying those data sets.
It's great to see how even when you're dealing with data that isn't naturally in a logical format, you can still adapt this approach and get really clear and understandable results.
And that brings us to the end of our deep dive into Tsutomu Sasao's classification functions for machine learning and data mining. What did you think?
I think the key takeaway is that this paper presents a really compelling alternative to using neural networks for classification. It's all about leveraging the power of logic synthesis and lookup tables. And I think the strengths are clear. It's fast, it can be implemented in simple and efficient hardware, and perhaps most importantly, it creates rules that are easy to understand.
I agree. It's definitely a method worth considering, especially if you're working in a field where speed, efficiency, and interpretability are really important.
Absolutely. It's not always about achieving the highest possible accuracy. Sometimes those other factors are more important. And I think the book makes a strong case that this approach can be very effective in a wide range of applications.
Yes, I think it's especially well-suited to tasks that require really fast decision-making like network analysis or high-energy physics. And it's also a great option when you have limited or imbalanced data, or when you need to be able to understand the reasoning behind a classification like in medical diagnosis.
So for you, the learner, as you continue on your journey of exploring complex information and making decisions, I want to leave you with a question. How might you apply these core principles of logic simplification and feature reduction in other areas of your work, even those that seem unrelated to machine learning? Maybe there are unexpected applications waiting to be discovered. Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive.